Good morning. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan, bringing you today's Wall Street Journal. Stocks. Wall Street's run it hot trade powers stock records. The Federal Reserve is expected to cut rates this coming week, and some are betting on a new burst of economic growth. By Jack Pitcher. The coolest trade on Wall Street is known as run it hot. While slowing job growth and tariff-related costs remain primary concerns for investors, the core of the trade lies in betting on an economic resurgence, not a recession. The thinking, tax cuts and falling interest rates will heat up the economy, fueling a new burst of growth. That line of reasoning has sent all manner of investments on records to records, from stock to Bitcoin to gold. Even if the labor market weakens further, many investors believe the near-term outlook remains bright, which they expect to fuel further gains across markets. "We've got an economy that's still growing strong," said Nelson Yu, head of equities at active asset manager AllianceBernstein. "It's not falling off a cliff, and I think it actually should be pretty good environment for risk asset if the central bank can start cutting rates." Wall Street's continued enthusiasm comes as a surprise given investors' main economic narratives. Many expect tariffs to hurt economic growth by taxing real income. The job reports was generally described as dismal, and Tuesday's revision showed the U.S. added 911,000 fewer jobs than initially thought in the year ended in March. Traders have largely shrugged off such concerns, instead embracing the prospect that lower rates will boost corporate profits. The Federal Reserve has signaled it's likely to cut short-term rates this month, and Wall Street expects more in the months ahead. The Dow Jones Industrial Average this past week crossed 46,000 for the first time. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ Composite are also hitting records. Higher risk, high valuation tech stocks are leading the way, and frothy corners of the market like meme stocks have taken off this summer. Nvidia, Tesla, Palantir, and meme stock Opendoor are the most traded stocks by individual investors in the U.S., and all are seeing net buys at Interactive Brokers. The core of the run-it-hot trade is the idea that U.S. economic conditions are going to be very strong, supported by easy monetary and fiscal policy, said Bob Elliott, chief executive at Unlimited Funds, who popularized the term. Elliott is skeptical. While few are calling for a recession, even a slow-growing economy would likely disappoint investors who are already expecting burgeoning corporate profits. David Kelly, chief market strategist at J.P. Morgan Asset Management, sees evidence of a gradually slowing economy that he expects will weigh on cyclical industries such as manufacturing or retail. "Lower benchmark rates aren't likely to turn that around," he said. "I think the stock market is just misinterpreting the state of affairs if they think that a rate cut here is going to do any good at all to the overall direction of the economy and its profitability," Kelly said. "When the Fed cuts, it cuts interest income. It convinces people that more cuts are coming, so they should wait to borrow, and it convinces people that the Fed is scared of a recession, so they become scared of a recession." Investors often buy bonds when they expect a slowdown, anticipating that lower rates will boost the value of existing debt with higher payouts. And treasuries have rallied since the weak labor market data began rolling in. The yield on two-year treasuries, which typically rises and falls with expectations for rates set by the Fed, recently hit its lowest level in 3 years. But longer-dated bonds have also rallied, perplexing some traders. They contend that an economic rebound will bring the question of overheating back to the fore and potentially push rates back up, reflecting more pressing concerns about inflation. That view has helped power gains and gold, which investors often buy when they are nervous or expect rising prices. Gold closed at a record 3,649 $3.40 a troy ounce on Friday, extending its 2025 gains to 39%. Bulls are making the case that the weak employment data is in the rearview mirror and the economy is clearly going to rebound in the back half of the year, Elliott said. I don't see evidence that that's happening. But the AI boom means some investors expect a strong economy to coexist with a weaker labor market, something that was once hard to imagine in America's famously consumer-driven economy. Torsten Slok, chief economist at Apollo Global Management, wrote Thursday that many indicators of consumer strength, like air travel and restaurant bookings, have remained solid, suggesting that labor market weaknesses could be tied to lower immigration than a slowing economy. Lower borrowing costs could also provide another boost for the boom in artificial intelligence investment, which has helped power stocks' recent run to records. Oracle gained $247 billion in market value Wednesday after announcing billions of dollars in contracts with three customers that revealed a bigger-than-expected footprint in the AI race. We have this tech investment cycle that's going on under the surface and providing support, so I think there's still good reasons to think the economy will be okay, said PIMCO economist Tiffany Wilding. But we have grown more concerned about the labor market. Economy. China's economy shows signs of summer slowdown. Broad slowdown hits world's second largest economy as trade uncertainties loom, property sector weakens, by Hannah Miao. Signs of weakness in China's economy stretched into August, adding pressure on Beijing to step up efforts to stimulate near-term growth. Momentum in retail sales, industrial production, and investment all slowed, while unemployment ticked up and the housing market continued to struggle, according to data released Monday by the National Bureau of Statistics. China also recently reported slowing export growth and persistent deflation for August. Taken together, the data suggests the world's second largest economy is showing some fatigue after expectation-defying growth earlier this year. They also signal that China's so-called anti-involution campaign to rein in extreme competition may be starting to curb excess production and overinvestment. Economists and policy advisors have been calling for Beijing to rebalance the economy to be driven by more consumption, with China's reliance on exports and investments to drive growth increasingly challenged by global trade tensions and slowing productivity gains. The fate of one of China's most important trade relationships remains unclear, with U.S. and Chinese negotiators meeting in Madrid for the latest round of trade talks. Still, some analysts believe Beijing may hold off on major initiatives to stimulate household spending as long as it remains on track for its target of around 5% economic growth this year. China's economy expanded an annual 5.3% in the first half of the year, driven by surprisingly strong exports, according to government data. But economists expect growth to slow the rest of the year as U.S. tariffs hit global trade and the boost from inventory stockpiling runs out. The main effort to boost spending so far has been a consumer goods trade-in program, offering subsidies for purchases of items such as household appliances and electric vehicles. That has helped drive retail sales since the program was rolled out last year, but could be running out of road since consumers only buy big ticket items so often. Retail sales increased 3.4% from a year ago in August, according to the government data, down from 3.7% in July and below economists' 4.0% forecast. Household demand has been weak in recent years as a prolonged property market downturn and worries about the economic outlook have pushed consumers to save money and watch their spending. Meanwhile, many industries are dealing with hyper-competition and price wars, especially in industries championed by China's leaders such as solar energy and EVs. Beijing's recent drive to curb excess capacity in key industries and this summer's adverse weather conditions, high temperatures, heavy rain, and flooding have weighed on factory activity and cut into industrial production, economists say. China's industrial production rose 5.2% last month, compared with 5.7% in July and 5.8% projection by economists. Fixed asset investment increased 0.5% in the first 8 months of the year, compared with a 1.6% year-over-year rise in the January to July period and expectations for 1.3% growth. The years-long property slump is another factor denting investment, say analysts. Property investment fell 12.9% between January and August, worsening from a 12.0% decline in the first 7 months. New home sales by value fell 7.0% in the first 8 months, widening from a 6.2% drop in the first 7 months. Average home prices in the major 70 Chinese cities fell 3.0% from a year earlier in August, compared with a 3.4% decline in July, according to calculations by the Wall Street Journal based on the Statistics Bureau data. China's urban surveyed unemployment rate came in at 5.3% last month, edging up July's 5.2%, as millions of fresh college graduates entered the job market. Earlier, China reported its export growth slowed in August to 4.4% year-over-year, the slowest pace in 6 months. Meanwhile, factory gate prices have been in contraction for nearly 3 years, with producer prices dropping 2.9% on year in August. Consumer prices have hovered around the flat line. Investigators learn more about suspect in Kirk shooting. Friends and families of Tyler Robinson have been speaking with authorities, according to Governor Spencer Cox, by Alyssa Lookpot and Joe Barrett. The 22-year-old man accused of killing conservative activist Charlie Kirk isn't cooperating with authorities, but those close to him are, Utah Governor Spencer Cox said Sunday. The Republican governor said authorities are interviewing family, friends, and acquaintances of Tyler Robinson, who was arrested on suspicion of shooting Kirk at a rally Wednesday at Utah Valley University. Formal charges are expected on Tuesday. Cox, who appeared on several Sunday morning news programs, said investigators were collecting forensic evidence and working to better understand Robinson's motivations. We can confirm that again, according to family and people that we're interviewing, he does come from a conservative family, but his ideology was very different than his family, and so that's part of it, Cox said on NBC's Meet the Press. The governor said that among those cooperating closely with investigators was Robinson's roommate, a romantic partner, who is transitioning from male to female. The roommate didn't have any knowledge of the shooting and was shocked when they found out about it, Cox said. Cox also confirmed a report by the New York Times that Robinson had messaged with acquaintances online after the shooting. Investigators say Robinson indicated that his father, that he was the shooter. A family friend contacted local authorities. Robinson was from the small city of Washington, situated in southwest Utah, between Red Rock Canyons and snow-capped mountains. The community has been shaken, with a note on the city's website expressing profound sadness regarding the tragic circumstances surrounding the shooting of Charlie Kirk and the recent arrests of Tyler Robinson. State records show Robinson's parents own a custom countertop business, and his mother is a licensed clinical social worker. He has two brothers. The family lives on a suburban street, where outside the front door on Sunday were bouquets of flowers and handwritten notes with messages such as, "I am praying for your family." Hundreds of local residents gathered Sunday evening for a vigil in honor of Kirk and to wrestle with the reality that his alleged killer had grown up in the community. They sang "God Bless America" and "Amazing Grace." Proud citizens of the United States are gathering peacefully to make sense of what has happened and to show that love and unity are critical in this time of sorrow and confusion, said Jordan Hess, Legislative Affairs Director for the city. Casey and Mallory King, a local couple in their early 30s, brought their three boys to the event to show them that divisions can be worked through peacefully. I felt a shift in the country. We're being more divided than we have been in recent years, said Mallory, who works in telemarketing. To me, it's important that we need to be unified in times like this. Casey, a carpenter, said the killer could have come from anywhere, but it is especially difficult to know he might have come from our backyard. Business. Whirlpool tells U.S. authorities its rivals could be evading tariffs. Citing federal data, company says declared customs value of numerous appliances from overseas started to plummet in June, by John Kilman. The appliance maker Whirlpool is stirring up a new trade dispute, telling the Trump administration that its overseas competitors could be evading hefty tariff bills by undervaluing their imports. Its claims are based on federal data generated from import paperwork. Whirlpool said the data shows that the declared customs value of numerous appliances started to plummet in June. A smaller declared value would mean a lower tariff payment. The Wall Street Journal review of the data shows that garbage disposals from China dropped from an average of $21 over the first 5 months of the year to $9 in June and then less than $8 in July. Gas ranges from Thailand more than halved to $175. Washing machines from South Korea sank from $838 to $73. The retail prices of those appliances, which carry tariff rates ranging from 13% to 60%, haven't shown a corresponding drop, Whirlpool said. President Trump has made tariffs a keystone of his economic policy, saying they will raise revenue, protect domestic manufacturing, and induce foreign companies to build factories in the U.S. To support that policy, the government has vowed to crack down on trade fraud. In late August, the Justice Department announced a task force that will focus on tariff evasion and smuggling. It has also taken action against U.S. companies that have allegedly run afoul of the rules. Whirlpool said that it has shared its concern with U.S. Customs and Border Protection and others within the administration, but hasn't filed a formal complaint. I would expect this administration to address any customs duty evasion quickly and decisively and send a message to potential future cheaters, said Daniel Calhoun, who is a Whirlpool advisor at Rock Creek Trade. Calhoun was a Commerce Department official during the first Trump administration. U.S. Customs and Border Protection declined to comment on the situation, but said it takes appropriate action when warranted. Whirlpool has a history of accusing its foreign-based competitors of unfair trading practices. In 2018, the company prevailed in having duties imposed on imported washing machines. Samsung Electronics and LG Electronics opened U.S. washing machine plants during Trump's first presidency. The current dispute began over the summer when federal data showed a large increase in the number of some imported appliances, along with a drop in their value. Whirlpool said it cross-referenced the data with its knowledge of its competitors' manufacturing facilities to come up with a list of companies it suspects of undervaluing imports. They include Samsung and LG, as well as China-based Haier, which owns GE appliances. Whirlpool, which produces 80% of its U.S.-bound appliances domestically, said that it has confronted its rivals about the data. Samsung declined to comment. LG said it is committed to complying with all U.S. laws and regulations. GE Appliances said that it takes customs compliance seriously and that Whirlpool's allegations are inaccurate, adding that Whirlpool, for example, alleged GE Appliances had imported a type of clothes dryer, but that it hadn't done so. We value competition and believe it is good for U.S. consumers, but this attack from Whirlpool looks like frustration over their own lagging performance, said GE Appliances, which has announced plans to expand U.S. production. Whirlpool stock is down around 20% this year as it struggles with sluggish demand. The company has predicted it will emerge as a winner after tariffs affect overseas competitors. Whirlpool said it stands by its conclusions. These are very large and sophisticated companies that know how to declare their imports, it said. Nunzio De Filippis, a co-chief executive of the customs brokerage Cargo Trans, said data entry errors could explain the situation. The implementation of new steel tariffs in June made reporting more complicated, and De Filippis said some brokers might be accidentally double counting the quantity of products, making it look as though appliance imports are surging and their per unit value is dropping. He said that U.S. Customs and Border Protection usually notifies brokers when it detects large statistical outliers. Ashley Coxey, National Director of Business Development at the logistics company Lawfer Group International, said customs agents are increasing inspections at seaports and airports to look for undervalued goods. U.S. companies, which often deflected responsibility onto their overseas suppliers, are coming under heightened scrutiny, she said. In a recently unsealed case, the Justice Department alleged that Barco Uniforms, a California-based seller of work garments, conspired with its suppliers to undervalue goods produced in China. Government attorneys said the suppliers handled the importation of the garments and were responsible for paying tariffs. Said the suppliers underpaid the duties that they owed and that Barco knew about and accepted the arrangements to get better prices. Barco said it broke no laws, bore no responsibility for paying tariffs on the products, and wasn't part of any conspiracy. We look forward to going to trial as soon as possible so we can prove our case and vindicate our reputation, the company said. World. China pushes for Trump visit as high-stakes trade talks begin. Fate of TikTok in U.S. also sits at center of U.S.-China negotiations in Madrid this week, by Ling Wei. For 2 months, Chinese diplomats have courted the White House, hoping to lock in a visit by President Trump to China that would grant leader Xi Jinping a significant diplomatic victory, according to people familiar with the matter. In return, the U.S. administration has straightforward demands, the people said. Tangible concessions or deliverables from Beijing on everything from trade to TikTok. So far, China has conceded little. Now a crucial round of trade talks in Madrid is poised to reveal whether Beijing is finally ready to give some ground or if it intends to press on with its delicate maneuver to secure a presidential visit by offering up as little as possible. Central to the negotiations that began Sunday between Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and his Chinese counterpart, Vice President Premier He Lifeng, is the fate of TikTok, the popular video-sharing app whose U.S. operations hang in the balance. TikTok has until Wednesday to secure a deal that satisfies a congressional order for its Chinese parent company, ByteDance, to sell its controlling stake. Trump has extended similar deadlines 3 times this year. The major sticking point is the app's powerful recommendation algorithm, its secret sauce. Beijing, which must approve any sale, has placed this technology on an export control list and has so far given no indication it will allow ByteDance to part with it, essentially killing any prospect of a deal. For the Trump administration, TikTok is now the litmus test. Any flexibility from Beijing on the sale would be an indicator of its readiness to make the concessions required to secure a presidential visit, the people said. China's Commerce Ministry said Friday that the Chinese side urges the U.S. side to meet China halfway and to resolve issues through dialogue. The ministry didn't elaborate on what such a deal would look like. A Treasury spokesperson declined to comment. The negotiations in Madrid, following 3 rounds of high-level trade talks between the two sides that all resulted in a tariff truce, come as both Washington and Beijing lay the groundwork for a potential leaders' summit later this year. Xi invited Trump to visit China when the two spoke on the phone in June. While officials in Washington are eyeing a late October gathering of Asia-Pacific leaders in South Korea as a likely venue, Beijing is signaling that it prefers a bilateral summit in China, according to the people familiar with the matter. That is because, the people said, Chinese officials want to better choreograph the event to make Xi look strong and to avoid any unwanted surprises. They are particularly worried about a report of what happened to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, who received a public dressing down from Trump in the Oval Office earlier this year. Chinese officials, who want to avoid a similar embarrassment for their leader, see the open press and unpredictability of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum as a risk. A tightly managed summit on home turf is their way of ensuring there are no missteps. Beijing is sending Premier Li Qiang to the United Nations General Assembly later this month, the people said, in hopes that he will meet with senior administration officials to make the case for a Trump visit to China. Li is expected to signal, according to the people, that if Trump travels to China this year, she would be open to going to the U.S. next year for the Group of 20 Leaders Summit. The central question is whether Trump will visit Beijing. Beijing is signaling they really want it, said Evan Medeiros, a former senior national security official of the Obama administration and now a professor at Georgetown University. Trump and Xi meeting on the margins of APEC is a backup option and one that Beijing doesn't want. But will they put enough on the table for Trump to visit? For now, Beijing is adopting a well-worn playbook for handling the U.S., engaging in protracted negotiations that will yield few tangible concessions. The strategy has also been employed by other world leaders to manage Washington's demands while advancing their own agendas. Russian President Vladimir Putin, for example, has dithered over the details of potential peace talks with Ukraine, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has similarly kept diplomatic channels open while pursuing his own military and regional objectives. But by stalling, Beijing risks frustrating its U.S. counterparts to the point of scuttling the very visit it hopes to arrange. So far, China hasn't acted on Trump's demand for a sharp increase in U.S. soybean imports. In addition, the two sides are at an impasse over the U.S. requests for China to crack down on the flow of chemicals used to make fentanyl. Beijing won't take action on the drug until the White House removes the 20% tariffs it has placed on Chinese imports as punishment for China's role in the fentanyl trade, the Wall Street Journal has reported. Beijing and Washington have entered talks about a deal for China to order hundreds of new Boeing jets. However, the plane maker first has to work through a backlog of undelivered jets. It reported more than 100 unfilled orders for Chinese customers through July. Therefore, according to industry executives, any new orders would be delivered years from now, possibly after Trump's term ends. Beijing's unwillingness to make meaningful concessions reflects Xi's resolve to engage in long-term competition with the U.S. Strategically, Xi feels empowered to harden his position from Trump's first term, during which 2 years of negotiations yielded a trade deal widely seen as favoring the U.S. Now the arsenal of trade tools China has built under Xi's leadership, including export controls of critical materials used to make chips, cars, and F-35 jets, gives Beijing the ability to cause the U.S. real pain. In a pointed move right before the start of the negotiations in Madrid, China announced Saturday that it had launched two probes into the U.S. semiconductor sector. The investigations targeting American analog chips for alleged dumping and U.S. restrictions for discrimination are a direct retaliation for Washington recently blacklisting 23 more Chinese firms. For the negotiations in Spain, the probe signaled a contentious start. Airlines, what you need to know about fume events on airplanes. The rate of incidents is increasing. Here's what you should and shouldn't be worried about when you fly. By Benjamin Katz. Due to design elements that has been a feature of almost every commercial jetliner since the 1950s, toxic fumes can leak from jet engines into the cabins or cockpit. You are listening to the Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am your volunteer broadcaster, Cicely Tiernan. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website at sunsounds.org. Then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Now returning to our article. The fumes have led to emergency landings, sickened passengers and crew members, and affected pilots' vision and reaction times mid-flight, according to official reports. The health effects are often mild, but can also be severe, including brain injuries. Here's what to know. Where does the air on a flight come from? On most planes, about half the air in the aircraft is recirculated. That refers to air that's already been on the plane that's breathed in and exhaled by passengers, with the remaining oxygen filtered and then pumped back inside the cabin. The other half is pulled from outside via the aircraft's engines using a system known as bleed air. Engines are used for air supply on every modern aircraft, with the exception of Boeing 787. Sorry, but why is my air pulled through an engine? Good question. Because air at altitude is very thin and very cold, it has to be compressed and heated before it can be sent to us to breathe. Aircraft manufacturers realized in the 1950s that jet engines were already doing that work, and they decided to bleed the air from the engine's compression chambers and then run it through the air conditioners to get it back down to breathable temperatures. Fume events occur when engine oils and hydraulic fluids leak into that section of the engine. Are all odors or vapors on a plane signs of toxic fumes? Definitely not. In fact, most smells reported in Federal Aviation Administration Service difficulty reports didn't qualify in the Wall Street Journal's analysis as a fume event. Other odors range from muffins burning in the galley oven to electronic equipment overheating. The same is true of vapors. One of the most common hazes in a cabin is condensation from the air conditioning system, which is unrelated to vaporized engine oil or hydraulic fluids. How worried should I be? It doesn't happen often. The rates we identified in 2024 showed an incident rate on top U.S. airlines of 108 per 1 million departures, or roughly twice a day. But we also know that fume events are massively underreported. Internal industry data reviewed by the journal estimated a rate of 800 incidents per million flights in the U.S., or just about 22 a day. Still, as one researcher put it, it's highly unlikely you'll be exposed, but almost guaranteed it'll happen on an aircraft somewhere in the U.S. today. We also don't know how toxic an actual fume event is because it can depend on the size of the leak and the temperature of the engine. The industry doesn't know what a typical leak looks like, and it can range from a small droplets slowly dripping into the air supply to, in extreme cases, liters dumped in a matter of seconds. Toxicity levels of any specific event can be confirmed by sensors and measuring devices, which the industry has lobbied against installing. What should I do if this happens? Fume events are usually noticeable and distinguishable from other odors that can enter the cabin. It might be worthy of informing your cabin crew if A, the smell is permeating through a large portion of the cabin, B, others further away have noticed it, and C, you or others are not feeling right. After that, always defer to your flight attendant. They're safety trained and know the procedures, including when a flight might need to be diverted. It is also important to understand that doctors and other researchers believe that scarier health effects are likely caused by repeated and prolonged exposure. Individuals often respond to chemicals differently and may be susceptible to effects at different levels. That means that while some might feel ill after an exposure, many won't. What about drop-down oxygen masks and existing air filters? Should I bring my own mask? Because drop-down passenger oxygen masks aren't sealed, they don't provide proper protection. In one extreme fume event investigated by the FAA, passengers stood on their seats to break into the overhead compartments to access the masks. That's a safety hazard that can cause other problems on a flight. Cloth and even N95 masks also aren't designed to filter vapors and gases. Until fume events have been addressed, often the best bet is to flag it to your cabin crew. Why do cabin crew appear to be the most at risk? There's some evidence indicating that repeat exposures coalesce to cause more severe damage. Cabin crew aren't just flying more, but are also more active when they do. That means their breathing rates are typically higher than a seated and docile passenger. While pilots have longer-lasting emergency oxygen supplies, cabin crew only have access to 15-minute oxygen tanks, which is often shorter than it takes for a pilot to divert and land the aircraft. Prolonged use of that oxygen supply is also dangerous. Also, it's possible we're only more aware of affected crew because of the lack of awareness among passengers. Whereas crews have avenues to report their exposure, passengers don't. Because symptoms can take time to manifest, the connection between exposure and symptoms becomes harder to make. India, Modi's strategy for mending ties with Trump, a stiff upper lip. India's prime minister has maintained a stoic silence in the face of sharp comments from the U.S. president while signaling he is eager to stay friends. By Tripti Lahiri in Delhi and Roby Gramer in Washington, D.C. President Trump launched a remarkable broadside against India this summer, branding it a dead economy. An administration official called India a laundromat for the Kremlin because of its acquisition of Russian oil. As punishment, the U.S. placed tariffs of 50% on Indian goods, higher than those recently imposed on China. Faced with this onslaught, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi's strategy has been clear. Do nothing. In a word, waiting, said Ashley J. Tellis, an expert on geopolitics at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, when asked about Modi's approach. The Indian government has displayed a remarkable equanimity in public while keeping open lines of communication to the Trump administration. An Indian official said that New Delhi has deliberately chosen to be measured in our communications and to not squander years of work improving ties with Washington. Such restraint may be paying off. Earlier this month, Trump said India and the U.S. have a special relationship despite the current tensions. Deeply appreciate and fully reciprocate President Trump's sentiments and positive assessment of our ties, Modi responded in a social media post. Then on Wednesday, Trump posted on Truth Social that trade negotiations with India were continuing and would soon reach a successful conclusion. Trump looked forward to speaking with his very good friend Modi soon, he added. But the deterioration of ties with the U.S. before those words of rapprochement had stunned India. While India historically had a position of avoiding Cold War alignment with either the U.S. or the Soviet Union, it tilted toward the Soviet Union as its major arms supplier and remains close to Russia today. The U.S., for its part, partnered with Pakistan, India's long-standing enemy, to counter the Soviet Union. But since the end of the Cold War, India has grown closer to the U.S. For the last 25 years, the relationship has been a great success story, said Shyam Saran, a former Indian foreign secretary, not only in terms of broadening it, but also intensifying it. Modi has cultivated close personal ties with Trump, despite some criticism of that approach at home. During Trump's first term, he joined the Indian prime minister as Howdy Modi, a rally for the Indian American diaspora in Texas, and later visited India. Modi was one of the first foreign leaders Trump hosted in Washington, D.C. after returning to power this year. U.S. Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard and Vice President J.D. Vance spoke of India in glowing terms during visits to the country this year. The Indian government also hired a former Trump campaign advisor, Jason Miller, as a lobbyist and advisor. Moreover, after Trump launched a trade war with Beijing, Businesses in India expected the country to benefit from companies looking to move out of China. But then in May, U.S.-India relations suddenly unraveled in the wake of a clash between India and Pakistan that erupted after a terrorist attack in Indian-controlled Kashmir. New Delhi blamed that attack on Pakistan-based groups. India and Pakistan each control parts of Kashmir, but claim it in full. India was angered by Trump's claims to have brokered a ceasefire between the two countries, something New Delhi has denied. Modi and Trump spoke for 35 minutes on June 17th, during which the Indian leader sought to explain India's stance on the ceasefire and its concerns over Pakistan, according to India's readout. According to Indian officials, Trump had invited Modi to visit Washington on his way back from the Group of Seven summit in Canada, which India declined, aware that Pakistan's Army Chief Asim Munir was visiting the U.S. at the time. On June 18th, Trump hosted Munir at the White House, a visit that upset the Indian government. In a statement, White House Deputy Press Secretary Anna Kelly said that President Trump was unable to successfully broker a ceasefire in May between India and Pakistan. Then the U.S. shocked India by announcing stiff tariffs on Indian imports in retaliation for India's large purchase of Russian oil, which rose from almost zero at the time of Moscow's invasion of Ukraine to nearly 40% of crude imports. India's close energy relationship with our adversary Russia is incredibly troubling, said Senator Jim Risch, Republican, Iowa, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. America will not tolerate support for Putin's war machine. Since then, according to an official familiar with the matter, Modi has been more cautious in his personal contacts with Trump. The U.S. sought a leader-level phone call the week of July 28th to help break an impasse over trade, but India was reluctant, the official said. The White House didn't respond to a request for comment on whether it has sought further calls with Modi since their June 17th conversation. As links with Washington have deteriorated, Modi has been seeking to mend ties with China, with whom relations have been in a deep freeze since the two countries engaged in a deadly border clash in 2020. In late August, Modi visited China for the first time in 7 years for a summit that also included Russia. In a carefully choreographed public appearance, Modi embraced Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese leader Xi Jinping. "Looks like we've lost India to Russia, and Russia to deepest, darkest China. May they have a long and prosperous future together," Trump wrote on social media days later, alongside a photo of the three leaders in China. Now relations appear to be on the mend. Sergio Gore, a senior White House aide whom Trump has nominated as ambassador to India, said India's trade minister is coming to Washington next week to discuss a potential trade deal. India's trade ministry declined to comment. "I do think it will get resolved over the next few weeks," he said during his public confirmation hearing before the Senate on Thursday. Miller, the Indian government's lobbyist, posted a photo on September 6 of himself meeting with Trump. Kelly, the White House deputy press secretary, said India and the U.S. remain in close contact on a range of diplomatic, defense, and commercial priorities. The U.S. and Indian militaries have been engaged in a two-week training exercise in Alaska scheduled to end Sunday. But in the India-U.S. relationship isn't likely to return quickly to where it was, analysts say. Trump's actions have cemented a longstanding distrust of the U.S. for many in India's foreign policy establishment dating back to the Cold War. They have also weakened the hand of more pro-Western policymakers in New Delhi who have long sought to deepen ties with the West, say U.S. and other Western diplomats. "Closer ties have stalled whether we like it or not," says Sarin, the former Indian foreign secretary. Commercial. Apple and Citadel fuel London office boom. Tech and finance companies, many from the U.S., are filling the swankiest spaces in the ancient commercial quarter known as the City by Anvi Bhutani and Joe Wallace. Larry Fink complains BlackRock is running out of desks. HSBC's new tower turned out to be too small. Ken Griffin's hedge fund, Citadel, signed a lease on a building 3 years ahead of time. The office market in London's ancient commercial quarter, known simply as the City, is booming. Fueled by an influx of American law and finance firms, a growing tech scene, and demand for the swankiest spaces to lure workers back to their desks. The boom shows Britain's finance industry has defied fears of a post-Brexit exodus. Despite losing some business and financiers after the UK left the European Union, London still hosts by far the biggest banking and capital markets in Europe. The buoyant market also reflects the district's broadening appeal. For decades, the area was a bastion of finance and insurance. Now tech companies, including Apple, TikTok, and several thousand smaller firms, vie for space, drawn in part by the prospect of easy access to potential investors. London, as a location for international business, seems to have really proven its resilience, said Martin Townes, who runs M&G's $43 billion real estate business. The city has a renewed level of vibrancy. The city, officially called the City of London, is a district of historic buildings and gleaming office towers packed into roughly a square mile of land on the north bank of the River Thames. It is home to the Bank of England, the London Stock Exchange, and St. Paul's Cathedral. The area was London's birthplace in Roman times, remnants of which are often dug up by developers. Dozens of trade associations known as guilds, some of which still exist, emerged when it became the principal place to do business in the Middle Ages. Canary Wharf, a dock-turned financial district in East London, prized banks away in the 1990s and 2000s with its shiny towers. But London's historic place of commerce is back in the ascendancy. Rents for snazzy offices in the city's newest towers have jumped more than 50% since 2020 to more than $160 a square foot, according to real estate broker Cushman & Wakefield. By comparison, Grade A offices in New York's Park Avenue, home to big banks and hedge funds, fetch about $116. The city drove a record number of leasing deals in the wider area last year, Cushman said. In New York, there has been a similar flight to high-quality offices since COVID. The City of London Corporation championed the construction of a new generation of skyscrapers to win back businesses. The centuries-old local authority has also worked to jazz up the area's cultural appeal, prodding developers to incorporate public spaces and dining spots. The quarter's central location and transport links are another plus for employers trying to encourage staff to return to the office. The city does face challenges. London's stock exchange is battling long-term decline. Britain's banks have struggled to compete with American rivals since the financial crisis. And though it throngs with workers in the middle of the week, the area lacks some of its pre-pandemic buzz. Footfall is still down at most of its metro stations. New towers have fanned tensions with heritage groups who worry about the proximity of new skyscrapers to historic sites such as the Tower of London. Planning constraints include rules to preserve views of St. Paul's. A cluster of skyscrapers has shot up this century, with nicknames such as the Gherkin, Cheese Grater, and Walkie Talkie. Several more developments, including one undershaft, which would be Western Europe's joint tallest building, have been approved. The new towers won't come soon enough to prevent a shortfall in offices in the next few years, said Kevin Dershowitz, leading director of Stanhope, a real estate developer. Many companies signed short-term deals emerging from the pandemic, he said, and some are now hunting for longer-term arrangements. BlackRock CEO Fink has lamented the lack of space in London after the asset manager's recent acquisition, telling Britain's Times newspaper earlier this year he would build his own office if he could do so quickly. BlackRock has a decade left on its lease near the Bank of England, and people close to the firm have said it isn't in any rush. New offices with bells and whistles are particularly in vogue. The city's tallest building, 22 Bishopsgate, has a Gordon Ramsay restaurant on its top floor and a climbing wall in the window of the 25th. Tenants include Apple, NASDAQ, and Skadden, the law firm. At 40 London Hall, tenants, including law firm Kirkland & Ellis and insurer Chubb, have access to saunas, a hair salon, and a screening room. The building, nicknamed Gotham City for its neo-Gothic-inspired design, opened last year fully occupied. Fancier facilities have boosted rents, pushing some would-be tenants to go elsewhere. One beneficiary is Canary Wharf, which has struggled since the pandemic because of its out-of-town location and aging towers. Having said it would relocate to the city, HSBC recently renewed its lease at its older home in Canary Wharf after realizing its new building won't fit anywhere. Hedge funds are among the city's fastest-growing tenants, according to broker Knight Frank, reflecting the sector's expansion globally. Last year, Citadel and its market-making sister firm, Citadel Securities, pre-let a third of Twin City Towers due to open in 2027, a major expansion of their London footprint. Another cohort expanding in the square mile, U.S. law firms, they are seeking to capitalize on a resurgence in deals involving British companies and to work with fast-growing private equity clients. Patrick Sarch, a partner at White & Case, said his team of mergers and acquisitions lawyers is growing to keep up with activity, driven in part by U.S. buyers looking for bargains in the U.K. market. The New York law firm took on two more floors of its office building in the city two summers ago. "Our lawyers are busier than they have been ever," Sarch said. "We are hiring partners, baby lawyers out of law school, people in the middle. There is a war for talent in London." World, it was a failing temple. Then it started offering God's help in getting a visa. Indian place of worship touts its power to summon divine assistance for people who want to study or work abroad. If we come here and pray, we get a visa. By Sean Lee and Akash Hassan. Devout Hindus often pilgrimage to temples seeking divine intervention in matters of health, wealth, and love. One holy place is known for aiding in a more earthly endeavor, securing a visa to go overseas. For decades, the faithful have flocked to the Chilkor Balaji Temple, commonly known as the Visa Temple, in the southern Indian city of Hyderabad, to pray for celestial help to study or work in countries like the U.S., U.K., and Australia. Some carry passports to be blessed by priests for an extra serving of good luck. Psychic anguish has reached a fever pitch among Indians since President Trump took office. Many college students are still without papers as U.S. embassies tighten vetting. The Trump administration also plans to revamp the H-1B visas for skilled foreign workers that are overwhelmingly taken up by Indian citizens. Thera Kumar Prabhakaran in April found out his software company paused his H-1B application out of fear new policies could lead down a black hole of paperwork. The 28-year-old software engineer despaired of ever reaching America. "I thought 50-50 chance this temple is real, but let's try it," said Prabhakaran. After a 16-hour bus ride, Prabhakaran removed his shoes, entered through a side door of the colorfully painted building, and proceeded to the marble-floored inner sanctum. Standing in front of the altar, which features a black statue of Balaji, he closed his eyes and prayed while clutching photocopies of his passport, employee ID, and a notice from the U.S. government that he had cleared an initial background check. A priest took the documents and lightly tapped them against the statue, which was swathed in flowers and tucked behind three doorways framed in gold leaf carvings of Hindu gods. "Everything depends on U.S. policy and Trump," Prabhakaran said. "You can work 100% hard and still nothing comes out. I need all the blessings." Back in the 1990s, only two or three people a week visited what was then a little-known place of worship to Lord Balaji, a local incarnation of the Hindu god Lord Vishnu. The head priest at the time, C.S. Gopal Krishna, decided to rebrand the temple as a sanctuary for those aspiring to travel abroad. "I named him the Visa God," said Gopal Krishna, a spry 81-year-old who still works at the temple. At its peak, about 70,000 people visited every week. Since Trump took office, there's been about a 20% drop in worshippers. Many are discouraged by shrinking job opportunities in the U.S. and the possibility of deportation, even with the proper paperwork. "They express their anguish, they express their worry," said C.S. Rangarian, 58, the head priest. "I tell them, have faith in God. Donald Trump is temporary, our Balaji is permanent." Prime Minister Narendra Modi has supported Trump's drive to deport illegal Indian immigrants, partly to safeguard legal paths for Indians to study and work in the U.S. Last year, India surpassed China as the top source of foreign students in the U.S., making up nearly 30% of the 1.1 million students from overseas. Lahari Kotha, 20, views praying at the temple as a spiritual down payment in advance of applying for graduate schools next year. The Hyderabad resident said that she hoped to earn celestial support to fend off worries that visa restrictions could derail her dream of studying at New York University. "Cosmic energy supports you to get good things," Kotha said. "Trump is bothering us, but we do what we can." Kotha's aunt, Sunita Karpurapu, said she regretted skipping a pilgrimage before applying for a visitor visa to accompany her daughter starting freshman year at Iowa State University. Her application was rejected a month ago, a misfortune she blames on her decision to pray at home. Over the years, the 35-year-old has made four trips to the visa temple. Each previous application, tourist visas for her family, and an H-1B visa for her husband was successful. "If we come here and pray, we get a visa," Karpurapa said. Ranjaranjan, the head priest, said visa seekers comprise a fraction of the 30,000 to 40,000 visitors a week. His God lends a hand in many obstacles, he said, including infertility, relationship quandaries, financial worries, and academic struggles. And that's all we have time for today. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Cicely Tiernan, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.